Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Walk the Talk Workshop of WCNA 31. I'm an addict. My name is Linda. Let's open this meeting now with a moment of silence, if we could, please. And the serenity prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Someone read, what is Narcotics Anonymous Program?
Hi, cousins. My name is John T. and I'm an addict.
Hey, John.
What is Narcotics Anonymous Program? NA is a nonprofit fellowship or society of men and women for whom drugs have become a major problem. We are recovering addicts who meet regularly to help each other stay clean. This is a program of complete abstinence from all drugs. There's only one requirement for membership, the desire to stop using. We suggest that you keep an open mind and give yourself a break. Our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. The most important thing about them is that they work. There are no strings attached to NA. We are not affiliated with any other organizations. We have no initiation fees or dues, no pledges to sign, no promises to make to anyone. We are not connected with any political, religious, or law enforcement groups, and are under no surveillance at any time. Anyone may join us regardless of age, race, sexual identity, creed, religion, or lack of religion. We are not interested in what or how much you use or who your connections were, what you have done in the past, how much or how little you have, but only in what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. The newcomer is the most important person at any meeting because we can only keep what we have by giving it away. We have learned from our group experience that those who keep coming to our meetings regularly stay clean. Thank you.
And someone has, why are we here, please?
My name is Gary. I'm an addict.
Hey, Gary.
Hello, everybody. Before coming to the fellowship of NA, we could not manage our own lives. We could not live and enjoy life as other people do. We had to have something different, and we thought we had found it in drugs. We placed their use ahead of the welfare of our families, our wives, husbands, and our children. We had to have drugs at all costs. We did many people great harm, but most of all, we harmed ourselves. Through our inability to accept personal responsibilities, we were actually creating our own problems. We seemed to be incapable of facing life on its own terms. Most of us realized that in our addiction, we were slowly committing suicide. But addiction is such a cunning enemy of life that we had lost the power to do anything about it. Many of us ended up in jail or sought help through medicine, religion, and psychiatry. None of these methods was sufficient for us. Our disease always resurfaced or continued to progress until in desperation we sought help from each other in Narcotics Anonymous. After coming to NA, we realized we were sick people. We suffered from a disease from which there is no known cure. It can, however, be arrested at some point, and recovery is then possible.
Usually, I know meetings that I go to when they introduce the speaker, you usually know who the speaker is. So I'm looking forward to hearing Allison. I know that already from leaving the big speaker meeting to get over here and be on time, she already walks the talk. So let's hear from Allison.
I'm an addict. My name is Allison. Sorry. And this is like the little teeny tiny meeting in the back in the corner in the dark. But that's all right because that's the way I use. I am utterly and completely privileged to be here, five people or 5,000 people. And I have to confess and thank one of the people in the room that I love the most, my sponsor. Because she knew how much I wanted to do anything at this meeting. read, share anything at this meeting. I used to live here, and I lived here 79, 80, 81, and I got clean in 87, so it might be a hint that when I lived here, things weren't great. I used to have a calendar on the wall, and I was thinking about that calendar when the Japanese woman was sharing at the larger meeting, and what she was talking about is that desperation and that darkness that we feel. I had a calendar that every single day for almost the entire time I lived here, I would mark that I would stop using that day. It never occurred to me I would get clean or that my life would change. I just had a goal that I would stop using that day. That one day, just one day, I could get clean. And not one single one of those days ever came true. Not one. Not one single day was ever clean. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about how I got here because I really think we all got here the same way. Slightly different versions, ages, races, sexual identities, whatever, but we got here the same way. But a snapshot of what Hawaii was like is for me the encapsulation of what my addiction became. I made some very bad choices in my life when I was using. I was sexually abused when I was a very small child. It went on from the time I was 3 until I was 13. There were many people involved. I was sort of passed around. And my choices as a teenager, as an adult, really reflected that. My relationships were poor. My choices were poor. My self-esteem was virtually non-existent. And I had gotten the second severe batter in my life, the second and the last. And he was gorgeous, he was an entertainer, he was a cocaine addict, he was a mean, horrible, twisted person who looked good on the outside. And he raped me in that house with the calendar and cracked my clavicle all the way down and broke my jaw, and I got pregnant from that rape. And I also paid some really big Hawaiian guys to move him out. And it was one of the smarter investments I've ever made. But I had to have an abortion, of course, because I just had to have an abortion. And I got an infection from the abortion and almost died from that. And then I got pneumonia. And when I finally got back to my fabulous job as a stripper on Hotel Street, and for any of you who have seen the special Hookers in Hawaii on HBO, that's where I was with the Mahus, and who are Hawaiian transvestites. I'm very good at it, by the way. The night I got back to my job, don't ask me how this guy knew. He robbed me of all my jewelry and money. What I decided at that point in my life is that the only logical thing to do was to move, because the only logical thing in my life was to run, no matter where I was running to or what I was running from, and absolutely no capacity to emotionally stand my ground. None. I was in many ways extremely tenacious when it came to getting drugs or when it came to getting whatever it was I wanted in that sort of twisted way we get what we want. But was I capable of finding myself and being true to myself? No, I had no idea what that looked like. So having worked in legal houses in Nevada, I made the decision, and I do mean whorehouses, I made the decision that what I would do is go back to Elko, Nevada, because I knew the woman who ran the house. And I gotta tell you, if your best step in life is finding a legal cat house to go to, things are not good, folks. They are just not good. I managed to get enough money to fly to Elko and to go back to work in a cat house. I had a huge heroin habit. I was somehow incredibly functional during that time. I was working two jobs when I was here, and I was attending the university. But I couldn't hold that together much longer. And I managed to get enough... I know it doesn't matter what we use, but let me tell you something. Arriving at a cat house with a bunch of Tussinex and Dilaudid, sort of hoping you can get through the 3 weeks before you get a week off, is just really not the optimum. And it was snowing. And I had come from Hawaii, and I arrive in, like, nowhere. If no one in this room knows where Elko, Nevada is, it is pretty much in the middle of nothing. It is a 5-hour drive from Reno, Nevada, and a 5-hour drive from a 3-hour drive from Salt Lake City, Utah. It is out in the middle of nothing. And there's maybe 20,000 people there. Most of them are miners, migrant workers, or cowboys. And I mean that literally. I don't mean like cowboys you see in movies. I mean cowboys with like glad rags, and they spend all their money on hookers. Thank bless their little heads. I love those cowboys. And that's what I did, is I went to this cat house, and I made the decision that that was like sort of the move up. And I had an epiphany when I was there, without going into detail. I had a tiny disagreement with a guy who was still on top of me. And well, that's where he was. So I flipped him off, and like literally off of me, and just went berserk. And so they have people with guns in these places to protect the girls. And so they came running in to protect me, because by now I'm screaming at the top of my lungs. This poor guy is being pummeled. I am beating this poor guy half to death. Because what happened was, every single ounce of frustration from the, like, by this point, like 27 or 28 years of using that I had left in me, was being displayed on this poor little man. And he's just screaming for his life. So I left. But I didn't stop using. But I finally got to a point in my life where I started sort of oddly, sort of sideways, looking for help. I was going to shrinks and doctors looking for some sort of magical, I don't know, cure. And I found two people who sort of helped me on my path. Actually, three people. It kind of all coincided. My father was looking for places to put me other than the nut house. He got sober in AA because he was just really a drunk. So I come by my stuff, honestly. And I went to my psychiatrist and my general practitioner sort of both at once, looking for the correct combination of pills or mercy, I don't know what. And both of them told me that I needed to stop using. And both of them told me that I needed to go to meetings. And one of them gave me a meeting list, and one of them gave me a basic text. And now that I've been clean a while, I realize how phenomenal it is that 20 years ago, someone in the helping professions didn't say to me, you need this combination of pills, or even you need to go to treatment, or you need to go to Betty Ford, or you need to whatever. They said, you need to stop using, and this is where you need to go. And I went for a couple of years loaded, really loaded, not a little loaded, really ripped to the tits. And I would go to AA on heroin and NA drunk. It seemed logical. It seemed very logical, by the way, because I didn't want to disrespect either fellowship. My connection was court-ordered. So I would go with him, and I would have the money in this hand, and I would, so that he would go. I think I wanted to keep him out of prison. I don't know what my logic was, because I can't remember. And then we would go to meetings. It also, blessedly, never occurred to me anybody could assign that slip. That bit of brightness never dawned on me. So I went to meetings intermittently for about 2 years, ripped. There's people in Reno who are still clean and who go to meetings who remember. And I would raise my little hand and share. And I never heard that if you've used today, don't share. And I don't know why people let me share. I'm incredibly grateful that they did. And now they have blackmail material. But I just kept going to meetings loaded for a couple of years. Not all the time, but sporadically. And I thought that it didn't apply to me. I thought that you, every one of you, and every one of you, those 8,000 people in that room over there, any one of the millions of us around the world, were somehow eminently qualified for recovery, but that for me, that it wasn't going to happen. That the best thing that would ever happen was that one of my family would come find me and put me in the nut house, because that's what they did. I come from a family that if you're an embarrassment, that they locked you up. And my grandpa Charlie died locked up, and my uncle Ray died locked up, and my uncle Bob died locked up. I'm not kidding, because they drank too much, and too much in my family was a lot. So, and I was definitely doing too much of everything, so I was pretty sure that I was sort of next on the list. And that was kind of it for me. I thought, well, that's what'll happen, that I'll just sort of go to these meetings long enough that somebody will find me and lock me up. And but I kept coming. And something happened when I tried to kill myself. I was very serious about it. I didn't leave a grandiose note. I didn't give a bunch of stuff away. I didn't call anybody. I didn't plan to have anybody coming over. I just took a bunch of stuff and decided that this was it. Because I had gotten to the point in my life where I started covering up the mirrors, and I am very vain. This is Botox and microdermabrasion, and I'm not kidding. And and yoga and diets and blah, 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 blah. You know, and if I need something else, I'm paying for it. You know, it's like I'm very vain, and I'm okay with that. But I had started covering up the mirrors because I could not stand to see who I had become. I had a job. I had an apartment. I had one of those guys that, ladies in this room will know the guy, that if you're really sick, you don't really have sex with him. He just kind of pays your bills and likes to take care of you and likes you really sick. I had one of those guys. And things on the outside weren't as terrible as they'd been. I mean, I've had times in my life when, you know, shooting dope with water from the back of the toilet was living high, as opposed to bad, dirty water from the gutter. So things were okay on the outside. But inside, after going to meetings for a couple of years loaded and thinking that I was the one who couldn't get clean, it never even occurred to me I could. I was just sure I couldn't. I made a very serious suicide attempt and didn't die. And I went into a psych ward after that. I'm very classy, always to the end. I got clean on a nut ward. And the premonitions and the predictions in my family came true. That's where I got clean. And the nurse who checked me in had 14 years in recovery. And she was incredibly gracious to me. And she said, you have tried everything. You have tried going to meetings loaded, because she had seen me. I hadn't seen her. I really wasn't focusing well. And you have tried using this for 30 years. You have tried killing yourself, and none of this is working. Try not using one day at a time. And I did. I stayed clean for 10 straight days on the psych ward. And it's, you know, really very easy to get medication on the psych ward. I have been in jail and in lots of different situations and never, ever, ever, ever gone 24 hours without using. That calendar I had on my house on, it was called Beetleman Street, and it was in the Tiki Punch Bowl, and that calendar that never had 24 hours clean, that calendar could have been the calendar of my life. There was never 24 hours clean except for that 10 days in that nut house where I did not get loaded. And I got out and got loaded. I just got out and got loaded. I drank. I don't think I was really clear. Well, I don't think I was really clear on anything. But for sure I wasn't really clear on alcohol as a drug. And I drank and then got loaded again. And I always tell the story because it's so us. I of course, going back to the really classy places, was using with someone on the third floor of this like ratty motel over a bowling alley. And I don't even bowl. And so I'm on the balcony, and I thought, well, I'll throw myself off and kill myself. And I thought, no, I will throw myself off and just break a bunch of shit and get paralyzed, and then I'd never be able to use again or do anything useful. So the next day I went to a meeting. My, I don't really know what day that was, to be candid. So my first sponsor and I counted some days out from that, and the day that I believe I had any real hope, certainly not of walking the talk, because I had no idea what that meant, or certainly no real hope of becoming who I am today, but the hope of having some capacity to stand up on my own, was July 23rd, 1987. And that's been a while ago, folks. That's really been, when I look at a calendar, it seems like a very long time. And when I measure my life and think about it, it seems like the blink of an eye. I had no idea of what was going to happen to me. I had no idea that what would happen in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, once I came here and made the decision, just one day, one minute, one second, whatever it took, that I would not use, that my life would change in ways that are so profound that there are days when I do not recognize myself. I landed Thursday, I'm sort of lost track of time. When I lived in Hawaii, I lost track of time too. I landed on Thursday. That was different though. I landed on Thursday and I'd flown over. I was on the plane with some people I know from Reno, whom I really love. I was so happy those people I liked on the plane. And they went, well, you know, you really don't want to bond with people from your hometown you don't really like, and you're on the plane with them for a real long time. I just seem messy. But they went one way and I went another, and I started walking in Waikiki, and that's where I first lived when I got here. And I was doing a lot of drugs and acting out, and I walked down Kuhio and I just started sobbing, and on sunglasses because Lord, you know, forbid that anybody see me sob in public. And I was just, tears were just streaming down my face. And I realized that the woman I am and the woman who walked down those streets, the difference is 1,000 years and 1,000 miles. And there is only one reason that has happened. And that is the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous and the miracle that happens here. I alone could do nothing. I alone was the woman who every single day marked that calendar, hoping for 24 hours clean, begging on my knees, crying, plotting. I have these journals that I kept from those years in Hawaii that are absolutely, positively heart-wrenching. Whoever that woman was, her guts were outside her 24 hours a day. Why someone didn't just scoop me in their arms to protect me, I don't know. Probably because on the outside, I always look like I can handle this. I don't care what it is, I look like, that's okay, I got it. Whatever it is, I'm pretty sure I'm on the job. and I am terrified of asking for help. So coming to the rooms in Narcotics Anonymous and saying, I am an addict and I don't know how to do this, was the hardest thing I have ever, ever had to do. And I got to tell you, there are plenty of days around here when it gets harder. Don't let anybody tell you that coming around for a long time that things get easier. Actually, I think they get harder in many ways. What happened the first year or so for me, and this I'm sure is blasphemy, but I know everybody says don't get in a relationship, don't blah, blah, blah. I screwed my way through my first 10 or 12 months clean. I just did. I couldn't sleep. I had a lot of sex, and then I could go to sleep. it worked. I worked the steps a lot. I had a lot of sex. It all seemed to make sense at the time. I had a sponsor who told me when to be at her house, what to write, and what time she'd be available. When I got clean, there wasn't any of this, oh, honey, when you feel better, we'll start on the steps. It was. I got time on Saturday at 1 o'clock, be there with your first step. This is what I want you to write. It never occurred to me to say no. She told me who to call. She said, you should make sure you call me. And there was a couple of my sponsee sisters. Make sure you talk to them. Do not just call the message machine. Make sure you talk to a human being. Talk to at least one other woman on the phone list. I don't care if you know her or not. Do it every single day. Go to a meeting every single day. I know people. I'll know that you're there. Really, she didn't always know I was there, but I didn't know that. I just went to meetings. I said, okay, I can do that. She is the first person who taught me how to walk the talk. She is the first person who showed me by example what life could be. She taught me if I said I was going to be at her house at 1 o'clock with my step, I wasn't there at 1:30. I don't care if I had to walk. I was there at 1. She taught me if I said I was supposed to call her and my sponsee sisters, that I would call them. She taught me that if I said I called her at 5 a.m., which was the time was convenient for her, by the way, because she worked early, I got up at 4:30 so that I was awake to call my sponsor. And I called her at 5 a.m. like she told me to. And I'm not joking, it was 5 a.m. for almost a year. And I did it. She showed me that if she said, call me at 5 a.m., guess what? It wasn't that she was asleep or not available, she was there. If she said, come to my house at 1 o'clock and work my step and work your step, she was there, and she was ready for it, with a pot of coffee on and listening to my sorry ass, who knows what I said that first 10 months. I mean, really, it just was probably like, wah, wah, wah. Definitely Charlie Brown material. I mean, I had been using since I was 9. I got clean when I was 40. Folks, I was not a pretty picture. I mean, there was a lot of crap rolling around in my head. My first 4-step took the poor woman 2 days. She said, I am never sponsoring anybody this old again. I love you, honey, but I'm done with you old broads. Fair enough. But I got mine. I mean, trust me, one more time, I got mine first. And I wound up, after that incredible, laughing, fun woman, with a couple of different sponsors. A lot of stuff happened. I learned also from my second sponsor, who has changed immeasurably, by the way, thank goodness for all of us, that just because you look really good and you have a great marriage and you have great clothes, you may not be walking any talk, by the way. You just may be talking a lot. it's true. I picked her for all the wrong reasons. I'll be candid. I picked her because she looked really good. She was really hip and she was very in. And I had never really been in. I'd sort of been on the fringes of everything. And I really desperately wanted to be in. It is very easy for me to admit that now. It was not easy then, believe me. I worked a 4-step with her. I've worked the steps through a lot of times, and I worked a 4-step with her. And I walked into a meeting a little bit late, and I heard part of my 4-step. Like it was a joke. And I thought, I couldn't have heard what I just heard. But I did, and I learned from that sponsor that there's a lot of people around here who are just talking, folks. They're just talking. And I suppose that was okay for her. It broke my heart. I didn't go to meetings for several days after that. And I'm pretty tough. I've been shot, stabbed, raped, robbed, you name it. And that hurt me more than almost anything did, because I was devastated by what I felt was such a private trust in a meeting. And I had to realize that it didn't matter. That the stuff I have done, really, we all did it. Every single one of us, man, woman, whatever. I'm looking at this handsome gentleman here in the gorgeous Panama hat. We did the same stuff. You know, maybe the details were slightly different, but we did the same stuff to get here. So really, when I thought about that woman sharing my stuff, and as much as I felt it was a betrayal, later on I realized, who cares? What we did to get here doesn't matter. How I felt about it was a little more private, but I had to learn who to trust. At 2 years clean, and then I'm going to skip way forward and talk about the importance of what I feel today, but something happened for me at 2 years that was extremely important for me in my recovery. I came very close to another suicide attempt. I had had, as I said, lots and lots of sex when I first got clean. And I had started overeating, and eating is just another symptom of the disease. And I had really gotten to a point where I was utterly and completely empty. And I could no longer eat, and I could no longer act out sexually, and it wasn't working. And I didn't know how to function. Even though I'd worked the steps through twice, I was left with this just enormous hole. I lived next door to a guy who was dealing something. I don't know what. Probably coke, but I was never sure, because I never went over to ask. And somebody had given me some really new sharp knives, which is probably a bad idea. Because my first couple of years clean, well, I was a self-mutilator my first couple of years clean. I used to cut. And so knives were probably not a great gift. But I found myself sitting on the floor wanting to call the 18-year-old that I was acting out with or go next door or disembowel myself with a knife. Because I had the knife on my hand and the phone in the other, and it's literally like this far from my door, and I know this is a tape, so it was like about 4 inches from the door. And something made me not do any of those things. Something made me make the decision to pull my sorry ass up off the floor and go to a meeting and tell on myself and tell about the fact that I was acting out in all these ways and not really be specific about it, but that it wasn't working and that one more time I needed to find a way to fill the hole with myself as opposed to bringing all that outside detritus, just the debris that comes with addiction and the debris that comes with life that looks sort of interesting at the moment, like food, sex, gambling, shopping. I still kind of got the shopping thing. Prestige, name it, you know, name it. And we'll shove it on in there because it really looks like the appropriate thing to do because, you know, I'm certainly not going to feel my way through this. I'm going to find something else. So at about 2 years clean, I realized that I had to start feeling, really, really feeling. It took me a long time before I stopped self-mutilating. I had about 6 years clean before I really, really stopped. And I had some really serious suicide stuff happen at about 3 and 4 years clean, too. I wound up walking the graveyard in Hollywood remember walking over Jane Mansfield and thinking, if I kill myself in this place, I will, possibly wind up here with some other crazy drug addict walking over, like, you know, trying to convince herself not to kill herself. So it seemed like a bad thing to do. So instead, I worked the steps, and I found a woman to sponsor me in L.A. who died with 37 years clean, and she and the sponsor I have now and the friends that I have in my life have shown me that you can be anyone you want to be, and that Narcotics Anonymous affords us the sort of broken, maimed, weird, twisted, charming, brilliant, funny, interesting, compelling people that we are, how to find ourselves and how to show up and how not only to parrot those steps, because I hear a lot of people in meetings, that talk great shit, and it's just that. It's just great shit. But they don't have a life that I want. And I found a woman with 30-some years clean who had gone through her husband dying of liver cancer and her son dying of muscular dystrophy, and her other son was in bed with muscular dystrophy, and she didn't get loaded through it. She instead gathered a lot of people in recovery around her and started leading by example. And she was a powerful, powerful, powerful lesson to me about how life can be led. And during that time, a woman came to me and asked me to be her roommate in L.A., and showed me how to be a mother. She and her son showed me how to be a family. And what I have learned in Narcotics Anonymous is from the people that I love, that if you say you're going to mother someone, that if you say you're going to sponsor someone, that if you say that you're working the steps, that doesn't mean that you're just writing them down on a piece of paper so that you can say, I'm working on my third step, or I'm working on my blah, blah step, or I'm reading the traditions. It means that you live them. It means that you take your child to daycare every day. It means that you keep your house clean. It means that you go to school and actually go and take the test. It means that when you sign up for something, that you complete it. It means that when you give your word is absolute, total bond. Someone gave me the greatest compliment I've had. One of my sponsees, before I was leaving, said something, and she said, I know that when you say you're going to be there, that if you're going to be there, you'll be there no matter what. You would have to be in a wreck not to show up. I know that when you say you're going to do something, I can count on you. I didn't learn that on my own, folks. I learned that from the women who sponsor me. I learned that from the women I've lived with. I learned that from my friends. I learned that from people who say, I'm going to come over, we're going to go to a meeting. Those people that have done for me. I didn't get some great 18 years clean with the life I have because I got something special. I didn't have some great miracle moment where a light went on. What happened for me is I learned from other people. I learned from that woman in outside of Pasadena in that little funky house that if you say that you're going to care for someone until the day they die, that that's what you mean. And consequently from that, when I fell in love with someone who later became extremely ill, man dying from AIDS that I didn't run away. He died at home. He died at home with me holding my hand, his hand, and his sister holding his hand, and his mother and father holding his hand in our house. Because the steps and the traditions and the people in Narcotics Anonymous showed me that if you tell someone you're going to be by their side until the wheels fall off, you better mean it, because the wheels just may fall off while you're on the ride. And that if it gets really ugly, and I mean really ugly, in the sense of what happens physically to us on the way out with that disease, and if people start abandoning you because it looks just like too much work, that you stay anyway, and you find out who your real friends are, and you find out who loves you and continues to come and continues to call. And guess what, folks? Those people were people in NA. The people that I know walk their talk. The people that I know when they say, we'll come pick you up and take you to a meeting and we'll stay with him for a while so you can keep your H&I commitment at maximum in the prison. That we'll come stay with him for a while and help you change the bedpans because you need a break. Or we'll take you to a movie and we'll hang out with him and read and play cards or whatever because you need that. But they showed up. Not one single person in NA who told me that they would be there didn't show up. They showed up. There was a handful of them. But let me tell you something. My mother told me years ago, if you can count your friends on one hand, you are truly blessed. Well, guess what, Mom? I don't have enough fingers and toes. I do not have enough fingers and toes to count the people that I know really love me. Now, I will tell you something. I'm incredibly lucky that the biggest group of people who really, really love me are in this room. I am incredibly lucky. I'm in Hawaii, in the town where I thought I was going to die, not once, but twice. Not just from the beating, but then from the infection. I'm standing here, with 18 years clean, a practicing lawyer, with my sponsor in the room, and my closest friends are in like 1, 2, 3 rows. I don't really get much luckier. My sponsee sister is here. I have the joy of recovery. I have the gift of love and honesty. I made a decision when I got clean that I was going to go back to school and I was going to live my dreams. That I was going to be who I wanted to be when I was really, really little. And one of the reasons that I asked my sponsor that I have now, and it's been almost 10 years, I can't believe that, is because she was living her dream. And my dream was to be a lawyer. I love to argue. And I do. And now I get paid. That's the best possible thing. But I thought that a junkie like me with the track where I got him, and let me tell you, I got him in some really odd and intimate places, not to mention my juggler. That's kind of like the obvious one. The other ones are really funky. That I was never going to make it in college, that I was never going to make it in graduate school, and I certainly wasn't eligible for law school, and I certainly was too old. Well, guess what, folks? None of that was true. I finished my 4-year degree and went back to work for a while, and then I took a graduate course at UCLA School of Law Extension and became a nationally certified paralegal with a great, great degree and career from there. And then went back and worked for a while, worked as a paralegal for years. And when my significant other got ill, I thought, okay, that'll be enough. Like, it's okay to be a paralegal. And something happened the moment he died. I realized, literally the moment he died, I realized that life is very, very short, that you blink and it's over. And then if I was truly going to walk my talk, but that thought didn't cross my mind. What crossed my mind if I was truly going to be the person that I wanted to be in recovery, that I was going to take a stab at it. And I was going to try and go to law school. And I got to tell you, I wasn't really sure anyone was going to accept me. And I had made this little journey to Boston where his sister lived. She's just this amazing woman who goes to Naranon. Can't say that I blame her with the addict brother and the kind of family that they are. They're just this incredible group of people. And I was on the Beantown trolley taking the tour. And the trolley guy goes, New England School of Law, first law school founder for the legal education of women. And I thought, I want to go there. That's where I want to go. And I certainly didn't think they'd accept me, but I applied there and a bunch of other law schools, and they were the first school that accepted me. Several others accepted me, and that was very exciting, but I wanted to go to the school founded for the legal education of women. They're co-ed now. They were formerly Porsche's School of Law, and they were this incredibly diverse school, and I knew that it would be okay. Something in the back of my mind knew that it would be okay. So at the age of 49, with not quite 10 years recovery, I turned 10 on the road. I went to law school with nothing but a law school loan, no job, no place to live, and decided it would all be okay. Got to Boston and went to a meeting on the Common and raised my hand and said, I'm an addict. My name is Allison. I just turned 10 on the road moving here. I'm starting law school in 4 days. I don't know anybody here. I need the strength of this fellowship to get through law school. And that's what I got. As a matter of fact, the guy who was speaking on the Mahalo cruise, Billy A., was my home group member at the Neon meeting in Cambridge on Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's the step study. It's a great meeting if you're ever in the Boston area. I found a home group right away. I found a group of people who loved me, and I called my sponsor, and I called my friends that are in the room on a regular basis, and I probably pissed and moaned and bitched and whined and cried and acted like the drama queen that I am the whole time I was there, because I worked full-time, and I went to law school at night, and I was on the interferon 3 times during all of this. And I volunteered every other weekend at a domestic violence shelter. And I went to meetings. And I sponsored people. Because goodness knows, I had a lot to make up for all those sort of dead years. And I made the decision that I was going to be a very productive member of society. And I think I did. I will tell you, the one and only time that it scared me was first year finals. It finally dawned on me, not my first exam, by the way, but my second one, that I could fail. I think I called my sponsor and said, it just dawned on me I could fail. I had gone through the entire first year of law school sort of on this NA cloud with step work behind me. You know, I got clean at the age of 40. I was pretty sure there wasn't anything that I couldn't do if I was willing to try hard enough. So the idea that I couldn't make it through law school had never occurred to me. I mean, I'd been in jail, I'd outrun the cops, I'd been shot at. I mean, I'd saved people from overdoses. I had done all that crazy ass shit we do. I had moved a million times. Law school, I mean, this is a very upscale problem. Law school, well, of course I can do law school. I mean, there are people... Never occurred to me. Literally, slightly over half my school made it through. I, like doofus that I am, I've got the steps, so I'm going to be fine. Well, guess what? I had the steps and I was fine. I graduated an honor student. I was on the dean's list. I was fine. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. My sponsor gets credit. I would call her and whine. But, truth is, my sponsor is a lawyer, and she was the person who showed me you can not only walk the talk, you can walk and talk. And fast. So I had this incredible epiphany that I could fail. And I don't know what she told me. I have no idea what she told me. I'm not, my grand sponsor writes down everything her sponsor tells her. I wish I had that. All I know is whatever she told me, I said, oh, okay. And I passed. And I went on to do much better my second year. And I got an offer to come back to Nevada. I'm from Reno, Nevada, in case anybody didn't catch that part. I'm not from California, but that's okay. I'm originally from California. And my home group is Leave Your Ego at the Door on Tuesday nights at 6:30. It's really tiny. It's a Just for Today meeting, in case anybody wants to come. But I had a bunch of offers. I was working full-time for multi-billion dollar international corporation. They asked me to stay. I had an offer in Delaware. I had legal service offers. I had an offer doing corporate work in New York. And it's kind of sideways. I got an offer from a woman I used to work for when I was a paralegal to go back to be the director of a legal service agency in Reno, Nevada. I had no intention of going back, to be honest. I didn't hate it. I wasn't going back. And when I first got clean, I wasn't capable of working, really. And the guy who likes you really sick didn't like me anymore because I wasn't sick. And I didn't like him much either, so I gave back the car and the checkbook. So I really wasn't. That was very hard. Very hard. I cried for days about the checkbook and the car, not him. But I couldn't really work full time. I was kicking a very long habit. And I'd only had 10 days in the psych ward. I did not get cleaner in a treatment center. Bless you who did. I'm very jealous. I had sort of a green trash can at the back of the meeting. And that was my treatment center. And I couldn't work well. And I applied for disability, temporary disability. And I got denied. And legal service agency, it's small, independent, helped me get temporary disability, and I got it for a while and then got off it fairly quickly. But it was just an immeasurable help to me. It really, really, truly took me to a place where I could sort of get my feet on the ground. And I got an offer to be the director of that agency right out of law school. And I felt it was karmically correct. And I'm not a huge touchy-feely person, by the way. I don't really hug a lot. I'm just not one of those people who go, oh, that was like the spiritually correct thing to do. But it's at that time it really was kind of like, poof, okay, that seems like the thing I should do. And I went back and I did that job for about 2 years. Oh, my God, what a political job. There is nothing, by the way, like being vetted by the Department of Justice when you know you have a track under your tongue. I don't know. The two thoughts were constantly in my head. I'm talking to the Department of Justice all the time. I wonder if they know I have tracks. They could not see me on the phone. But I was somehow in the back of my head still like, ooh, you know, I know I'm the next dope fiend. You know, did they know? They probably did know. But they also probably knew who I was. I was the director of this agency. I'm going to talk really quickly about how I got to be an attorney, and then I'm going to shut up because I think it'll be time. Because I have to say this because it is the prime example of where Narcotics Anonymous will bring you. They didn't want me to be an attorney in the state of Nevada, folks. They didn't. You have to go through this 30-page moral fitness thing. Now, you can get pretty funky after you get to be one, and they will hustle you off to treatment. But if you are funky before, there's a little problem. And I was like the queen of funky. You have to register to be in the cat house, and that was on my rap sheet. And then I had like, I have a really long record. And it's sealed in the state of Nevada, and there's some stuff done to it in California. And in Nevada, I can actually answer the question, have you ever been arrested? No. Legally. Yes, of course. You want to work for the FBI, be a practicing physician, or an attorney. Well, I wanted to be an attorney, so I had to answer yes. And I had to produce my rap sheet. Well, they were not impressed. There are no felonies And it was, by this time, like, I had not been arrested for 20-some-odd years, and yet and still they were not impressed. They were even not, and look, to my way of thinking, impressed that I was in recovery. So they made me go through hell and back. I gotta tell you, I worked the steps around that a lot. I think my dearest friends in the room heard me whine and cry. And for real, I was terrified. That wasn't like, I can handle this. That was, I am terrified. I have gone through this process, gone through law school, passed the bar exam, reached my wildest dreams, and I could be stopped from my past, from something I have not done. At that point, I had almost 15 years recovery. I had not been arrested for 23 years. I had no felony conviction. This cannot be happening to me, folks, and yet it was. I had to tell the board of directors where I worked. I had to tell my 15 employees. I had to tell a couple of attorneys I wanted to write letters for me. A couple of them knew and didn't care anyway. And I had to hire an attorney to the tune of almost $5,000. And I had to fly down to Las Vegas after I put this big package together. And I had to go through a hearing. And something amazing happened. They walked out and they said to my attorney, whatever they said to him, they said, talk to him privately. And then he came over and he said, I want to tell you something. I said, what is it? And he said, they just tell me that they don't want me to say much. And I said, oh. He's like, you know, I'm ready to vomit. I feel like I got 10 days clean and I'm asking my first sponsor to sponsor me, and I almost threw up then. So I'm just literally ready to vomit. I'm holding my stomach and I'm thinking, I don't know. And he said, they've already made the decision, and that's not the sentence I wanted to hear. They've already made the decision and they're going to pass you through. They just want to go in and meet you. And I walked in that room, and the men that were there, ladies, it was all men, for whatever reason, but the men that were there had less time clean than I did, and two of them were crying, because they were so grateful to have one of their own come in to be a barred attorney in Nevada. And they stood up and thanked me for my recovery. And they stood up and thanked me for showing that we do recover. And I thank you. And I couldn't have gotten to that moment without the people who taught me how to get through. The people who taught me how to do the right thing, even when I didn't want to. How to do the right thing, even when I wanted to pout and scream or turn around and say, this is too hard, I can't do it. This is absolutely, positively too hard. I am not capable of doing this. But that's a lie. That's an absolute lie. It is much more than the lie is dead, we do recover. The lie is dead, we become all that we want to be. Thank you. I'm an addict. My name is Allison. Namaste.
Thank you, Allison. Come on, it's late. Come on, let's give her another hand. Can we get a volunteer to come up and read just for today, please? Thanks.
Yeah, my name's Robin. I'm an addict. I'm from London, England.
Hello,
Rob. Just for today. Tell yourself. Just for today, my thoughts will be on my recovery. Living and enjoying life without the use of drugs. Just for today, I will have faith in someone in NA who believes in me and wants to help me in my recovery.
Just for today.
I will have a program. I will try to follow it to the best of my ability.
Just for today.
Through NA, I will try to get a better perspective on my life.
Just for today.
I'll be unafraid. My thoughts will be on my new associations, people are not using, and have found a new way of life. So long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear. Thank you.
Circle up.
Guide me in my recovery. Show me how to live clean. Become happy.